Hello and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm your host, Alejandra Bronfman. My very distinguished guests today are Sally and Richard Price, authors most recently of Samaka Dreaming with Duke University Press in 2017. This remarkable book looks back on their initial encounter over 50 years ago with the Samaka Maroons of Suriname, drawing from their research notes, memories, recordings, and photographs, and tells the story of how they learned to live with and write about the people and of the place itself, and of the ways their work and the history of the place eventually became intertwined. I welcomed the opportunity to speak with both of them for this interview. Please be aware that the sound quality suffers in spots, and I apologize about that. I hope you enjoy it nonetheless. Richard, Sally, thank you so much for joining me today.
Our pleasure.
So this is a book about a place and a group of people that you've been working with in some way or another for 50 years. Can you go back to the moment when you decided that this was the place that you were going to work in?
Sure. We had done a good bit of fieldwork as anthropologists among your students. I first in Peru when I was a sophomore at Harvard. In the summer after that, I went up in the Andes in the Vicos project that was run by Cornell University. And that's when I really decided I wanted to be an anthropologist. I had taken a freshman seminar with Clive Cluckon that had gotten me interested, and I went on from there. After that summer, I was able to get a fellowship to do a summer in Martinique in a fishing village right near where we live today. And the following summer after I graduated, Sally and I got married, and we went back there to Martinique together. We spent 4 months there before we went to Paris for a year of graduate study before coming back to Harvard to finish up graduate work. And during that time, and then we went to, while we were in Paris here, we worked in Andalusia together, wrote some articles about that. Each time, we were writing up our work, publishing it. And after that, we then went to Chiapas in Mexico as part of the Harvard Chiapas Project and worked with Zinacateco Indians. And it was only during my first year of graduate school at Harvard when I started working with Sid Mintz, who was at MIT visiting, that we made the decision that where we really wanted to work permanently was in Afro-America somewhere. And as we read more and more, it seemed to us that the Maroons of Suriname would be the most exciting place to go and spend time. And so that's what we did.
So why this book now? You've written many books, articles, monographs, novels, put together exhibits. How does this book fit in with everything else that you've done?
Well, we went back in our minds to the very early experiences that we had with Samaka, which is kind of a follow-up to all the other things that we've been writing. And we decided to dig back into our file cabinets and find the notes that we had written in between 1966 and 1968, mainly, also some from the 1970s. And it was kind of mind-blowing. We relived the day-to-day experiences that we had with people we've come to be very close with. And in the book, we try very hard to recreate the experience of being in that situation, not as a nostalgic return to some, dreamscape, but really going into the relationships that we have with all our neighbors, the things that we participated in, the way that we wrote field notes, which was sort of interesting to see, how the field notes were written out in terms of making things explicit or including things that were just understood. So we've tried to recreate that experience, which was it was very moving for us.
The book does that really successfully, I think. You get a real sense of your learning curve and the kinds of things that you encountered and didn't know about and eventually got more comfortable with. But at the same time, there's a kind of layering. And you open with a quote about haunting. And I wonder if you can talk about why you did that and what the haunting refers to.
Well, that was a late addition. I think that we have a very special relationship to this place and those years, because 20 years after we began our fieldwork in 1966, we were expelled from the country by the dictatorship, and we've never been able to go back to that place, to that country. We've continued working with the Samaka people, but in neighboring French Guiana, not in the Republic of Suriname. We're able to go to French Guiana, but not to Suriname. And that started in 1986, which is more than 30 years ago. So all in all, this place where we lived in Dongobo, the village we lived in, that region where we lived and visited over a period of 20 years, is a kind of dreamscape for us. So going back is very special, and it does haunt us in all sorts of ways today.
So I found the book a little bit difficult to place genre-wise. It's a memoir, it's an ethnography, and it's also a kind of reflective commentary on your own work over the years and the place of your work in the general literature. So I'm wondering if you deliberately wrote it that way so as to elude categorization.
I take it as a compliment that it doesn't fit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Category. I think, the most interesting books don't.
I think many of our books are like that they are across categories. The so-called novel we wrote certainly is and was taken as such. And I think I remember Marshall Solins writing a review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review of a book that we wrote in the 90s called Equatoria, where the fact that it didn't fit into a genre bothered him. He said he felt like he was being jerked around or something like that. So we like that.
There's a difference between expectations in the United States and in France. In France, it's much stronger for people to want to categorize a book. Well, is this a book of essays? Is this a monograph and so on? The French are really very strong in wanting to categorize like that. But I think in the United States, it's not really true.
I really enjoyed it, and I feel like it gives us permission to write in ways that are more creative and more kind of evocative in different sorts of ways. So I very much appreciate that.
Well, we've always tried to write, I think, in ways that break genres and that are evocative in different ways, in different books.
Yeah. So to plunge into the book a little bit, and I don't think we have time to really talk about all of the details of everything, but you chose to focus on three individuals, Agbago, Kala, and Nai. And I wonder if you can just take some time to describe those individuals and why you chose to focus on them.
Well, one reason was that you had to have some kind of focus to this whole society of many, many people that you're dealing with on a daily basis and so on. So Agbago was the supreme chief of the Saramaka people. And he, when we first went there, he must have been in his 80s. A very dignified man with a deep voice and a real authority. And he essentially made the decision to allow us to live in South Africa. So he was very important in that and continued to have relations with him throughout our stay. What he decided was that he wanted us to live in his natal village, which was different from the village that he lived in. And he arranged for us to have a house built right in front of the house that belonged to his older sister, who was well into her 90s, and that was Sai, who we also became extremely close to. And there was another, so this is a sibling set, the Supreme Chief, his elder sister, and then his younger brother, Captain Kala, who was the captain of the area that we lived in. And that was a different kind of relationship, also a very strong relationship, but marked by moments of contestation. And maybe Rich should talk about him some more, because he was the one who had to.
Kala was a man with whom I ate all my meals under his house, often with several other younger men, not younger than him, but older than I. And let's remember, when we started out, we were in our mid-20s. And he was a man who was very sort of traditionally Samaka, in that he had a great fear and hostility toward anyone who was an outsider, and particularly towards white people, and who are traditionally the enemy of Samaka's. Samaka identity is built on the idea of the wars they fought against the whites for 100 years during the late 17th and early 18th century, until they made peace with the Dutch crown in the middle of the 18th century. And that spirit of battle and being warriors is something that's very, very important to Samaka. So almost every day, Captain Kala was not only the political chief, but the spiritual chief of the village, would go to the village ancestor shrine and pray. And when he prayed, he would always say, as part of his long prayers to the ancestors, I don't know what to do with these people. I don't know what to do if one of them died. I don't know how to bury a white person. And that was something he was very concerned about. He and I had a lot of difficulties here and there. On the other hand, we ate all our meals together. We chatted about everything under the sun, except those things that were prohibited to outsiders. During the 1960s, for instance, I was not allowed to ask anything about what some of us call first time, that is, the period of their wars against the whites. And I didn't. I obeyed pretty much what I was supposed to do. It was only 10 years later that I not only got permission, but was asked by the Supreme Chief of the Samakas, Kala's older brother, Abago, and others, to begin to record their early history, because they feared that it would be disappearing otherwise. And, of course, Sally had other restrictions that were very, very important, and Kala was the one who watched every move that we made to make sure that we were living up to the standards that they were setting for us. Her restrictions had to do with female pollution.
So Kala would tell us, if I was in the menstrual hut, he would make sure that we understood that that I could not touch something that had been killed, some meat, and cook it for Rich, or certainly not for him, that there were restrictions having to do with food and cooking and where I could sit and what I could do and so on. So he watched over that very carefully. But the other person who was really, really important to us was Nai, not for several reasons. One is that as the oldest woman in that part of Saramaka, that village and the surrounding villages, and as the older sister of the Supreme Chief, she had a status that meant that people would come to her for every possible kind of problem. a difficult pregnancy or a marital problem or a ritual problem and so on. So that a lot of important things happened in front of her house, and that's where we lived. Our houses faced each other right in front. And she started out by being terrified of having these two white people living in her village. We only learned later how scared she was, how she would go to the ancestor shrine and pray that we wouldn't kill her and so on. And with time, we became very, very close. Her relationship with Rich was a ritualized husband-wife. My relationship with her was a playful co-wife. We called each other by the term, it's like a playful co-wife. And by the time we had been there for even just 6 months or so, she and I became very close. And she shared things with me that were very, very touching. And she once showed me an object that she said must never be shown to anyone else except it's like a sex toy, actually. It was a beaded belt that that every woman has for tactile pleasure during sex. And she said, you know, nobody can see this, and when I die, it's buried in my coffin with me, but I can show it to you because you should know. You know, she understood that we wanted to understand everything about ceremonial life. So it was a very touching relationship. Very different from our relationship with her brother, Paula.
And after we left, at the end of the first 2 years, of our first 2 years in Salamanca, when we were back at Yale, my first job, Nai died, and she was buried. Her body was carried to the cemetery in the bottom of our personal canoe. That's what she had wanted.
The other thing that she was very concerned about was that she figured that I was old enough to get pregnant and I wasn't pregnant, and that concerned her a great deal. She said, you know, after I die, I'm going to be the spiritual janitor, the spiritual janitor in the conception of your child. Because Saramakas see conception as being done by the man, the woman, and a spiritual participant. And so she said, I will play that role for you because I really want you to have children.
These relationships sound really fascinating. And one of the things that's really interesting about them is the ways that you, in the book, as you tell it, navigate the questions of belief and possession and ritual. And I'm wondering what your approach was when writing about these. And I've had this question about with other texts that you've written as well. How do you situate yourselves in relation to beliefs and practices? And did that change over time as you learned more about the ways that people thought about the world?
Are you asking whether we believed or what?
Well, I'm curious as to how you the process of writing about it, actually, and the process of thinking about it, because to me, your texts are the most compelling in the ways that you manage to explain what people believe and not merely sort of orientalize what they're doing.
I think it's pretty simple. We always felt, and still today, when we go to French Guiana, feel that when we were going into Salamanca territory, let's say we went to the city for 4 or 5 days, which we did every few months, to buy certain supplies. When we came back, when we passed the beginning of Western territory toward the city, we left Salamanca thinking behind, and we became our normal Western selves. When we went back up the river, when we crossed the first waterfall, we went another world, and it was a world which was filled with spirits that lived in Crees and rocks and that possessed people and that talked to us and we could talk to them. And the reality of that was patent. And if I think of a much more recent, my more recent experiences in French Guiana, which I talked about in a book called Travels with Toy, he was a man who was often possessed by a particular spirit. We talked to, you know, on a daily basis when we were with him, he talked to us, who knew us, just the way his brother knew us or his wife. And it's not a question of, you know, whether you believe in it or whether you don't. Or as far as we were concerned, the way I like to think of it is that when we're with people who act this way and think this way, we do too. And so that we've always tried to write about this, not, say, from the point of view of Herskovitz or many anthropologists who, you know, talk about whether it's, use psychoanalytic sorts of explanations of what's going on in spirit possession or whatever, but rather simply talk about it as accepting it. The same way that I, in other words, when I talk to Toy's brother who had a spirit that that began in the 18th century, who witnessed a lot of 18th century events that are very important, the Saramakkas, this spirit that is now in this man's head witnessed, you know, what happened in 1755, certain events that a lot of people have told me about and I've read about in the archives and so on. He was there and he tells me things. I can talk to him about things that happened then. And for that book, I simply record or translate what he was telling me, what our conversations were like, because I'm really, really interested. And I let the reader judge what the reader wants to judge.
I think that that's actually the key, is that you simply, well, you don't simply, it's not simple, obviously, it's very complicated, but you write about it rather than sort of offering a big sort of theoretical framework. It's just is, it is what it is. And, it, and that for me makes it very, very compelling.
I think it's a kind of total acceptance.
Yeah. Yeah, that really comes through, I think, in the writing, and I think that that's just I don't know. I'm always drawn to that.
Our idea is to try to help the reader of our books, who's somewhere else in the world and who's never had these experiences, understand and feel something of what it's like to talk to a particular kind of warrior god who's talking about something that happened in the 18th century.
Yeah.
Rather than try to explain what might be happening, we're simply trying to allow someone else to share an experience.
Yeah. So another thing along those lines, that struck me is the way that the book moved between moments of sort of absolute quotidian detail. There are children playing, there are chores, and then suddenly there are these moments of high drama or tragedy or kind of explosive situations, and the ways that those are, they sit together and they sort of juxtaposed against one another. I found that fascinating.
I think it's a true reflection of what life was like in the Saramakka village. I mean, the idea that children are playing and, you know, ordinary things are going on, but then all kinds of highly dramatic things happen with gods and spirits. And I mean, that's the way life was there.
Yeah, that's conveyed really clearly. And another question I had actually with regards to the women and the gardens. And you talk about the ways they go to the gardens and they're these places of sort of harmony and peace and escape a little bit. And you talk about them as a way to escape from the stresses of village life. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what those stresses were. Why was it stressful for women to be living in these villages?
Well, the social problems that there are worked out in the villages. And when women go off to their camps, they're with sisters and sisters-in-law. They're not with co-wives. They're not in the same company. They also don't really have to behave the same way that they do in villages. They can be extremely casual in their clothes, and it's also a place where there is abundant food. The men come and hunt in the forest, and they have all their garden produce and so on. So it's a place that women feel relaxed and comfortable in. Often, when a woman has her period and she's supposed to go off to the menstrual hut, she'll say, "No, I'd rather, take my canoe and paddle up to my garden camp and be there, since I'm not, in the village. I'm not allowed to do a whole lot of things. So why not go up to the garden camp with my sisters and relax?" It's really beautiful to be up in a garden camp. I mean, the several times that we went to work, there's something very, very special about being in the middle of the forest with all kinds of garden produce around and hunting and so on. It's a wonderful environment.
And in the villages, there are very strong social responsibilities of different sorts at different times. People interact with each other. When you wake up in the morning, normally you go and these are villages of, say, 200 people, 150 people, something like that. And some are larger. Normally, you wake up and you go around to every other house in the village and ask people how they slept and say good morning. So everyone knows what everyone else is doing and where they've slept and how they've slept. And these are polygynous. This is a polygynous society. Men move around a lot. There's a lot of tension between co-wives. Most men, when we were there, had two or three wives. Co-wives have a lot of tension among them. That all takes place in the villages, as Sally suggested. There are ritual obligations. When almost every day someone is sick, there's some series of problems. There are deaths. There are all sorts of bad things happening, and for that, people get together and they go to the ancestor shrine in little groups, and they have obligations to pray together and to do rituals together in order to make things right again, to cure people, to fix something in the spirit world that's been disturbed, and so on, to do divination together of one sort or another, to find out the reason why so-and-so has a toothache, and then do something about it. So there are always things to do in the village. And
those aren't things that are taken care of in the garden camps. They were really just in the villages.
So it's such a fascinating rendition of a life that's that's very dense and very busy and almost performative in that way. And the camps are these places of escape where none of those obligations apply. And the fact that they can go back and forth, I don't know. I found that really, really fascinating. So towards the end, the book becomes quite reflective, and you talk about your decision not to go back in response to threats from the military government, but also the ways that the writing emerged from that and the ways that you continued to do field work. And I'm wondering, at the end, you also talk about the way you've become intertwined with the telling of the place. So now the stories that you tell are also have become part of the history and vice versa. So I'm wondering if that's what you imagined 50 odd years ago when you first started working there.
No, I think we had no idea, 50 years ago, what was going to happen with our lives or theirs.
But one situation that we find ourselves in now, which I think we would never have predicted, is that we are becoming a resource for the children of Saumakas who have moved to French Guiana and have grown up speaking Saumakan, but not living in, not experiencing the life of villages as we did in the 60s, and who sometimes even email us with questions about certain kinds of life rights or what was it like when this and that and the other thing. High school students will get in touch with us and say they want to understand certain things about what life was like because it's their heritage, but they have never lived it. I mean, these are people who have grown up in the towns of French Guiana who have sometimes visited a few times to the villages on the river and feel that that's their identity, but they don't really, they haven't lived it, they don't know it, and they turn to us sometimes to ask the questions that they have in mind. It's a funny kind of relationship.
It's one of the reasons that during the last 20 years or so, we have worked to have probably a dozen of our books translated into French, because about a third of Saumakas now live in French Guiana. The kids all go to French schools, they speak French, and those that are interested read. So having our books in French for that educated Saumaka population is important to us. And it's from those younger people that we get lots of questions on Facebook and by email. We also ended up translating two of our books into the Saumaka language. They're the first books ever published in Saumaka. And one is a translation of my early book, First Time, about Saumaka early history, The Wars Against the Whites, which the Saumaka people asked us to translate. And the Saumaka people bought 3,000 copies of that book and distributed it in their schools and in their villages. So that made us feel very good about being able to give something back.
And it was so much fun to do that we decided to do a second book, which was a book called Two Evenings in Saumaka, a book of folktales. So we now have two books in Saumaka. And one of the nice things about that, we had to work out an orthography to decide whether to use accents and how to render a language that hadn't been written before. And we came up with something that Saumakas can read. They have no trouble reading it, so it's very accessible.
It's also an orthography that can, because it doesn't have any accents, it can be used on Facebook or any other social media, and Saumakas are now using that a good bit. So that makes us feel good.
So it's a story of the production and circulation of all kinds of knowledge through all kinds of media, and including written and oral language. I mean, it's really it's much more than writing books, what you guys are doing, I think.
Yeah, it's all, and another piece of it has to do with photographs and drawings, because younger Saumakas are well known for their artistry, visual arts, and men are wood carvers, and women do all sorts of fancy sewing. And our book, starting, I guess, with a big catalog that we did in 1980 of an exhibit, African American Arts of the Australian Rainforest. Afro-American Arts of the Australian Rainforest that California put out, was we gave lots of copies of that to Samakas, and there are now the grandchildren of the carvers who are represented in that book, who use that book as a kind of model of inspiration for the carvings that they do in French Guiana today, which they sell to tourists. So, and the pictures that we published in various books, the art, are also used, were also used by a forger, for instance. That's the guy we wrote a novel about, the Nemo Variations, that Harvard published. And that had to do with images that we had published and which were then taken over by a Frenchman who decided to forge Salamanca art and sell it. And
we've always been really struck by the fact that you have no control over what's done with your books once you write them, that they go out and you're used in different ways. There's one example where we published a picture of a textile, I guess it was a shoulder cape, patchwork textile, and we are always careful to put the name of the person who sewed it and so on. In this case, it was sewn by a woman named Pepina. And we recently discovered an artist in the Netherlands who is doing what he calls a Pepina series. And it's painting. It's a wall. There's a wall painting. There, you know, he's done it in different forms. And they're all called after the name of this woman from the early 20th century, whose shoulder cape appeared in one of our books, which he kind of latched onto and made the subject of a whole series of artworks. So you can't predict.
Yeah. One last question about that. Have you received responses about the book from people in it who are still alive? I think you mentioned that there are a few.
No. We don't know that anyone in Suriname has read the book or has a way of getting the book. There's only one bookstore in Suriname, and though we've tried very hard to get the book in there, the only way anyone can buy our books in Suriname is by knowing about the book and going to the store in the capital and asking, you know, and putting down money and pre-ordering it. We know that with our books in French, that some sometimes when someone's going over to French Guiana, which often happens, with it's only 3 hours away on a road and a quick canoe ride, when someone is going over, someone who can read might say, "Will you get me a copy of such and such a book?" Because there, our books are in French, or sold in French Guiana. But otherwise, other than when we used to give out books, when we would go to Suriname, and we would bring lots of copies of, say, first time, we really couldn't do anything. So, excuse me. So, in fact, we've had no reactions to this book, really, from anyone.
I've taken up a lot of your time. One last question before we go. Can you say anything about what you are working on right now?
Yes. What we're working on, about 15 years ago, in 2003, we published a book in French. It's the only book that we wrote directly in French. It's called Les Marrons, The Maroons, in French Guiana. And we wrote it for school teachers, for lawyers, for doctors, for nurses, for prison guards, for everyone in French Guiana who deals with Maroons every day. Maroons are one-third of the population of the country. We wrote it for them because they have no idea who these people are. There are Samakas, Jukas, Pamakas, Alukos, four different Maroon groups. They speak different languages, they have different histories. They're quite different one from another, But from a French point of view, or a French Creole point of view, they're just a bunch of, you know, primitive black people. And so we wrote this book for them in order to talk about the history of each of these groups in French Guiana and the different languages they speak and the sort of employment niches they have in the country and so on. We have hundreds of students in the University of French Guiana in Cayenne are Burundians. But teachers, professors don't know who they are. So we wrote this book for them 15 years ago, and it turns out that there have been tremendous changes in the last 15 years for Maroons in Guiana, in French Guiana. So we went back to French Guiana during January and February this year, did a number of weeks of field work. We went to every part of French Guiana where Maroons are living. We did a lot of demographic work, and we did a lot of talking to people. And we're bringing out a completely new edition of this book, which, again, will only be in French, except we talked about it last week in the Netherlands. We gave a couple of lectures, and the Dutch publisher said they want to do a Dutch edition and sell it in Suriname because people in Suriname don't know much about neighboring French Guiana. So it will be in French and Dutch, but presumably not in English because we don't imagine that people in the United States or really care very much about Maroons in French Guiana. It's really a service book that tries to teach people who these in French Guiana who these people are. And it has lots of pictures, it's printed in color, and it only costs something like €15, so $17. So it's something that every school teacher, every lawyer, doctor, nurse buys at the airport when they come into French Guiana. Most of those people are white French people, young ones, on their first teaching assignment, that sort of thing, because French Guiana is a very far away place for most French people. So it's a book that we think is very important. It's maybe our best-selling book.
It's our only book that's sold in the airport.
Anyway. So that's what we've been working on for the last few months, and it will be coming out later this year.
That sounds really important, and these people are lucky to have you guiding them through, I suppose. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Great. Thank you. We've enjoyed it too.